KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program, where we explore issues and organizations related to our community. Talk of the Rock is hosted by members of the KMXT news team.
Well, welcome to Talk of the Rock here on KMXT. I'm your host, Davis. And today I have Mr. Toby Sullivan from the Maritime Museum. Toby, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And we're into 2026 now. I'm not sure about you, Toby, but I still sometimes forget to change the date on when I'm signing something or stamping something. I'm still saying 2025, but we are, in fact, in a new year. And I thought it was about time that, we caught up with you to talk about what happened in 2025 for the Maritime Museum. So where would you like to start? Because there were a few things that happened for the museum this past year.
Yeah, it was an eventful year for us. And thanks for having me on here to kind of tell our story. As most people know, we've been a museum without walls since the late 90s. We've had an administrative office down in a city harbor office in Dog Bay for years. But we weren't able to show exhibits. It was for office space, and we had some storage, but not much. But last year, Jerry Markham, a local attorney who was born and raised here, he gifted us a house on Lower Mill Bay. Actually, it's called Mill Bay. It's easy to get confused. It's the road right up the street from the legislative office. And his family home was right on the corner that was actually built by, I believe, Alf Madsen, one of the Madsens, that big gray house. And then the little house next door to it, 215 Mill Bay Road, a little brown house, was owned by Jerry Eberman, who was a fisherman for many, many years. And Jerry Markham bought the house from Jerry Eberman back around 1980, and then he rented it out. And then last year, I had been talking to him for 2 or 3 years on ways to help the museum within his capacity. And actually, one of the Fields brothers, Wallace's older brother, Weston, who I used to have breakfast with about 3 times a winter at a diner up there on Mill Bay Road. We'd talk about the museum and history, and Weston was friends with Jerry, and I think he put a bug in Jerry's ear. And so I was down in Seattle, and I met with him a couple times, and we kind of hit it off personally, telling old stories about Kodiak. He has a couple of great earthquake stories and things like that. But he went off to law school. He didn't want to become a fisherman, and he was a very successful lawyer here in town. So anyway, he gifted us the house last year. I think we signed the papers on December 31st of 24, and then we moved in March. And so we've been using it out as an administrative space with a little bit of storage, not much. But it's good to have a home that's our own. People can stop in and find out what's going on. But so that was a big deal for us.
And that's still the building that has Jerry Markham's law sign on the front, right?
That is his family house.
His family house, okay.
The museum is the one right next door,
right
going
next door.
Up the hill.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So not the one on the corner, but sort of right next to it.
Right.
Yeah.
But his family house in its own right is a museum all unto itself. It's chock-a-block full of – it's a beautiful house inside with all this native wood, it's laid out pretty cool. But Jerry and his mom were collectors of artifacts and paraphernalia, and it was also a rooming house for many, many years. So there's actually a totem pole in the stairway.
Wow.
Not a full-size one. I don't know the history. There's all kinds of things in there.
Interesting. And the Markhams, of course, owned one of the historic bars in Kodiak. I'm trying to remember which one, but we talked about Jerry Markham and a historic exhibit for the Kodiak History Museum on Kodiak's historic bars. And now I can't remember which bar it was. But anyway, you can find more information about that on the Kodiak History Museum website, too. Great. So the quest for a physical building still continues, but you do at least have more office and storage space at this point.
Yeah, we have the office space, storage building in the backyard. We've got a yard which we are considering. We're working right now with getting possession of a Bristol Bay double-ender boat that was built in 1929 and used on the Kwajalein River. It's down in Washington on Lopez Island. and it was gifted to us by a gentleman down there who his boat project didn't come to fruition, and he's got to get rid of this boat. So we're going to bring that up, and we may have to put it somewhere on the lot. We're still examining that. But I think the real mission for us at this point is finding a place to do exhibits. And, of course, we've got in Alitac, the cannery down there has this museum built by Woody Knebel over the years with help from all kinds of people in the Alitac community. And it's a remarkable collection of cannery artifacts from the Olga Bay Cannery and the Mosier Bay Cannery and the Alitac Cannery. And when the other two canneries were dismantled in the early 2000s, they took a lot of the pieces out of it. And so Woody assembled them. And for a guy who was a cannery guy, not a museum guy, he did an amazing job of laying this stuff out in a museum format inside the cannery in a secure walled-in area on the cannery floor. So we've done a catalog of it, cataloged all the objects, and the next step is to get them to Kodiak.
And we're talking about like 150 items, right, or more?
Yeah, and they're everything from, you know, something small you can hold in your hand, like a hook or a tool, to these large machines. We're not sure if we can get it all up here. It's still to be decided. The finest piece in the collection is about a 24-foot wooden dory that was used as a sailing gillnetter in Olga Bay. And it has a mast and a sail, and Woody restored it all. It even has a little wooden roller in the stern for the net to go out. Very cool boat. It's amazing. And we don't know the exact provenance of it, like where it was built. I suspect it was built in Seattle or San Francisco. But it's on the cannery floor, and it looks to me like you could put it in the water and go from there. I mean, it's wow. In really good shape. And we have pictures of it from when it was in the Olga Bay Cannery. Woody documented that before he moved it to Alitac. And it was just like sitting in a corner, abandoned, with about 10 coats of paint on it peeling off.
Yeah. I mean, amazing, amazing collection. And as you're saying, I mean, that plus everything else that the Maritime Museum already has certainly needs a place to be stored properly and to be displayed, to be exhibited. So I think the other part, and maybe this is where you're going, is your proposal for the Griffin Memorial Building.
Yeah, so none of that is tied up in a bow yet.
Sure.
But to refresh people's memory, the state owned the building for many years, and public health was in there, Millie Sugita and all that. And then 2 years ago, they gave it to the city, and the city, I think, is still processing exactly what they want to do with it. But there have been discussions with us, the Kodiak History Museum, and maybe another nonprofit or two, I'm not really sure. And we've been talking with the city about, like, what to do with this building. And there is a need for museum space between the two museums. This building could fit that bill to some extent. If it fits within the city's mission and goals. And of course, nobody signed anything yet, and we're in discussions about, well, what would that agreement look like? If it was a lease, what would have to change hands to make that happen? But the city has hired an architecture firm, Wolf Architecture, and they have drawn up some floor plans for how it could be utilized for the two museums for storage and exhibit space. Those are pretty exciting to look at the floor plans. It's still a wish in one hand, and we'll see how it goes. So we're hoping that this year in 2026, we get further down the road with the city. I mean, the city has a lot of projects going on, and they have their own agenda, which is, of course, appropriate. But this is one thing that's important to us, and I think it's important for the city to decide what to do with the building. It is a very historic building, built in 1940. It's Art Deco style. It was originally built as a hospital, used for many years. It's amazing how many people you talk to over a certain age, right, who were born in that building,
right,
in Kodiak. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, just a couple weeks ago, I was speaking with Pat Branson and Molly Odell from the Kodiak Historic Preservation Commission. Mm-hmm. And they were mentioning how, you know, they're really pushing for that Griffin Memorial Building to be on the National Register of Historic Places. So
that's right. And Margaret Greitert down at the History Museum, who is a brilliant young woman, as far as this administrative activities go, she's working on that application. I'm on the commission as well, and I've been just watching from the sidelines. It's way beyond my abilities. The paperwork and the, you know, knowledge of national law is pretty intricate, but Margaret seems to have a handle on it. And I think that'll really, really help. And of course, the Historical Commission is, in the last 2 or 3 years since it's been up and running, is now working on a listing of properties in Kodiak. And it's really amazing to have everybody that's interested in history kind of all working in the same direction with that commission in an organized fashion. And it gets us federal recognition for that, and there might be some funding that's available as well.
Well, that's very exciting, and we'll keep updated on plans that the city moves forward with for the Griffin Building, and we'll see what ends up happening. But in the meantime, I know that, you know, the Maritime Museum has still been able to do sort of these moving exhibits, right? You do some temporary exhibits in different spaces. And this past year, you did one on limited entry.
Yeah, that's right. It opened, I think, in January last year at the History Museum because we didn't have any exhibit space. But the 50th anniversary of the limited entry program was, depending on where the marker is, it would be either 2025 or 2024. So it was meant to kind of memorialize that and kind of talk about how the limited entry program got started, why it got started. So the exhibit was here for a few months, and then last summer it was at the Bristol Bay Historical Museum in Naknek, and I flew out there and during salmon season and gave a talk. And then on February 2nd or something like that, I'm going to go to Homer and talk about it there at the Pratt Museum. And so it's actually really cool that these are three communities which are really wrapped up with limited entry and the salmon and herring permits and that program. And the history of it, I mean, most people as of this time, 50 years on, don't really think about what it was like before limited entry and how it came about. But basically it capitalized what had previously been open access, which was free, just like water or air. But after that, you had to pay money if you wanted to go salmon fishing. And that was a sea change for the fishery. And it was the beginning, really, of the privatization or the commodification is another word for it, of all the fisheries in the United States. And it's a worldwide trend. There's very few open entry fisheries left. There are a few where you just buy a license and go catch the fish, the cod fishing in the Bering Sea, for instance. But most fisheries have been commodified, where someone owns access to it. And what the exhibit tries to explain is that how the program turned access into a capital asset, which you can borrow money against, the IRS can take it, you can get divorced and lose it to your ex-wife, all those kind of things. Before that, you just bought a boat and a permit and you hired, or a license, and you hired your guys and girls and you went fishing. So it's a whole different world. And the other thing that the exhibit talks about is how resources all over the planet have over time been commodified, turned from open access to something you have to pay money to use and have legal rights to. The big one, of course, is land. When Europeans got here, that land, nobody owned it. But now every square inch of North America is owned by somebody. And it goes all the way back to Great Britain, where they had these common lands, which were farmed by peasants but owned by the local earl or duke. And he let these folks just farm on it for subsistence. And over centuries, up until about 1900, all of that was privatized in Britain. And that same process was applied to fisheries in the United States and elsewhere.
A reimagining of fiefdoms, in a sense.
In a way, yeah. Because what it does give rights to particular people to go fishing or to own this piece of land. But at the same time, it excludes people who do not have those rights. And that has great social consequences. In Great Britain, when they privatized all this commonly owned land, they ended up with millions of peasants who no longer had the rights to be on that land as commoners or peasants just farming. And they all ended up in the cities of Great Britain working in cotton mills, or they went to Australia, or they went to North America. And by the time they were got to North America, these were like the second wave of immigration to the United States or the colonies. They got, this was starting around 1790, 1800, 1840. And those people, all the flatland on the coast was already taken in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and South Carolina. So they ended up in Appalachia, a lot of them. And that Appalachian culture comes directly from the peasantry of England and Scotland. So you can see a direct line of that.
Wow. If you're just joining us here on KMXT's Talk of the Rock, we are spinning some yarns with Mr. Toby Sullivan. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Toby. And from the Maritime Museum perspective, I'll just, before I move on, I just want to make sure if folks missed that limited entry exhibit, is there still a way to view that online or maybe watch a recording? I know we did something on it for KMXT, but...
I'm pretty sure it's on our website.
Okay, great.
I confess that I haven't updated the website in the last month or two, so I need to go back and, because you know how you think you got it all set and then the link doesn't work. So I need to check on that. So
fair enough. Yeah. Okay. But in the meantime, though, you are, you said you have a talk coming up in Homer next month.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's Saturday, February 7th.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Mm-hmm. What other projects or plans do you have for this year? You got another exhibit in the works?
At this point, it's the Alitech collection. Yeah. And as I mentioned previously, a side project is this Bristol Bay double ender that's down on Lopez Island. We need to get it to Kodiak. Well, first of all, we need to get it from Lopez Island to Port Townsend and get it cradled up. And Brian Johnson is shipwright who helped rebuild the Thelma Sea, and he fished here for many years. He is kind of the project manager on that end of things. And then we're going to move it up here. And then we'd like to, it's in good shape. It floats, it has a mast, it has sails. We'd like to clean it up a little. And, the discussion amongst myself and the board is what is the ultimate aim of the project? Do we want to just exhibit it? What I'd like to do is sail it around in the harbor and take people for boat rides.
Hey, there you go.
So we'll see how that goes. But the boat was built for the Knock, I think it's called the Knockout Cannery, which is on the north side of the Kwajalein River. And we have pictures of boats there in the 30s. And this boat has a brass plaque with a number on it, like number 43 or something. And in one of the pictures we've got, these boats are lined up on the mud bank, and you can see the numbers painted on the bow, and there's a number 43 or whatever the number is. Is that the same boat? We'd love to believe so, because then you have physical documentation of the boat in a certain place at a certain time, which is the gold standard for historical exhibits. Some more research needs to be done on that.
But then, I mean, either way, that is, as you're saying, that's a great reference point too, because then you can maybe find some documentation related to that date and time and location.
That's for sure. And Kodiak has a couple of these boats still in Kodiak. These Bristol Bay boats that were brought over from Naknek in the late 70s, I think, by Tony Jones. He brought a couple of them over. But this one, those are privately owned, and people have their own program going with that. So this would be our project. And we're seeing it as a teaching moment because, of course, Bristol Bay is hundreds of miles away, but lots of people here have fished there for over 100 years. So we're very culturally and economically connected with that fishery. And this boat is a way to physically show that connection.
You were mentioning earlier, too, you know, how the Kodiak Maritime Museum, you know, every so often works with, you know, like the equivalent in Bristol Bay, Dillingham, or in Homer, right? I mean, you've had, I think, traveling exhibits come up from the Aleutians, even, on Alaska. But what's the collaboration there? What's the relationship between your Maritime Museum, which is the only Maritime Museum in the state, and then some of these other organizations in different communities?
Well, it's... very ad hoc and informal. We don't have an association of these kind of museums. There is Museums Alaska, which we all are members of, which is a compendium for all the museums, art museums and everything. But the history museums, the smaller ones like us and Homer and Bristol Bay, and then the Museums of the Aleutians, Museum of the Aleutians in Dutch Harbor, we all talk and email about different projects, but we're not really coordinating more than that.
Okay, understood. So yeah, like with here in Kodiak, you know, there's the Historical Society, there's things like the Historic Preservation Commission, which you're a part of, right? But there's no, as you were saying before, there's no centrally focused organization that collaborates between some of these museums without physical spaces, without walls. Yeah,
that's about right.
Yeah.
Museums Alaska coordinates programs to help museums survive and, you know, organize themselves politically. Because just like KMXD knows, it's been a tough year for nonprofits and museums as well. Millions of dollars in federal funding have just evaporated. So everybody's trying to be creative to keep going forward without that source of funding. There's still funding in the pipeline, grants that were granted. My understanding is most of those will keep coming. We actually don't have any federal grants outstanding at the moment. We did have a National Park Service grant for this limited entry program, but that money's been spent and we don't have to worry about it anymore.
I imagine it's probably a little bit harder to qualify for certain grants too without a physical museum.
Well, that is interesting. The Institute for Marine Museum Library Sciences, IMLS, we actually applied for a grant some years back, and we didn't get it because we didn't have a physical exhibit space. I didn't agree with that, but they were the ones writing the check, so that's the way it was. But we haven't had a great deal of trouble explaining ourselves and justifying our mission. We've been pretty good at that.
Well, and let's just talk a little bit more, too, about some of the other things that you know, the Maritime Museum does annually, but specifically even this past year, I mean, you do quite a few public events, the traveling exhibits. Folks will most recently remember the Harbor Lights Festival, of course. what else can you point out to folks, though, to say, hey, here's the Maritime Museum and here's how we're active in the community?
Well, we did the Harbor Lights Boat Parade. Of course, there was an accident involved with that. I think most people saw the fireworks, and I think there's a discussion going to happen about the future of the parade regarding that, because I think the Coast Guard and the city are not completely happy with some of the things that happened. So we're going to have to figure that one out. We also do the Crab Festival booth. We sell codfish, which we get from Richard Thummel and Kevin O'Leary's longline operation in the Bering Sea. I do have to say that is the best codfish ever anyplace, and I like codfish. And so we do that to raise money. And then we had a raffle this fall for the first time, which was very successful. And, you know, Alaska Airlines gave us two vouchers for $1,750 apiece, and a couple people won prizes for that. So we're going to do that again. And those are fundraising efforts. We're hoping that if we can get a physical space with exhibits, it opens up a whole new world to reach out to the public and tell stories. And I think between the, there's four museums in Kodiak, which is remarkable for a town this size. And I was talking to Joe Stevens, of course, at Safeway in the vegetable aisle about the Kodiak the museum out at Fort Abercrombie. And, you know, there's so much overlap between all these museums in the stories we tell. But one thing that's always been really cool is that the museums all sort of work together on presenting this history, even though our subject matter is blurry between us. The Venn diagram is, there's a lot of intersecting circles. But I think, you know, for the Maritime Museum, there was no one telling the story of initially in the 90s, the three fisherwomen who started a museum, they looked out and they could see limited entry happening, not limited entry, but IFQs, the federal programs in the 90s, and they could see the fishery changing rapidly. And of course, at the time, there was several derelict wooden boats in the harbor, and every now and then they'd haul one out and burn it on the beach over there in Near Island, and that was freaking people out. to burn these historic boats. But there really wasn't an alternative for the city. They just couldn't leave them in the harbor. The owners had vacated. So from that, there was a feeling that somebody needed to tell the maritime history. Originally, it was just focused on Kodiak, but there was no one telling the maritime history story in the rest of the state. Now, admittedly, we do not have the capacity to tell that story. We're fighting, or what's that? What do they say? Punching above our weight class.
Exactly.
In a major way. But, you know, you aspire to what you want. And as Margaret Mead says, nothing happens without trying. So that's where we're at.
Well, I appreciate you bringing up the storytelling angle, too, because, again, in speaking with the Historic Preservation Commission, you know, one of the goals or action items from that first ever historic Kodiak historic document, now I'm already blanking on the name, but the discussion was also around, you know, there needs to be some more storytelling events, right? Some more opportunities mm-hmm. for folks to just tell stories. And I'm wondering, I mean, you do walking history tours right on the waterfront at the docks. You know, you do obviously a bunch of storytelling yourself as an individual, but I'm wondering, is the Maritime Museum going to maybe get involved in the storytelling hosting side of things?
That has always been on our agenda in a general way. I do think we are... I'm going to try and get some funding this year to fire up our oral history program again. Now, 20 years ago, Sue Jeffrey and Lacey Burns, they had these oral histories they were recording, and then they were having these evening events where they would sort of have a kind of like a talk show venue on a stage where they'd have some, I hate to say old person, but somebody with some experience telling stories under kind of an interview thing. And that has crossed our minds as doing that, you know.
Yeah,
that may happen.
That would be awesome. Yeah, I think a lot of folks would probably enjoy that. Yeah, and just to remind people, how can they get involved with the Kodiak Maritime Museum? Because you are pretty much an army of one, Toby.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way because we do have a board of directors which does a lot of work. I keep the books and answer the phone, but we do need a couple more board members. It's always good to have fresh blood. And they can go on our website, Kodiak Maritime Museum, kodiakmaritimemuseum.org, and our phone number's on the website. And if anybody wants to help out in any ways, large or small, we'll take the help.
Great. Well, that wraps up our time already, Toby. I appreciate you coming on Talk of the Rock today and plugging the Maritime Museum. We look forward to, maybe seeing some new projects, a new fishing boat coming through from Bristol Bay. That would be awesome. And keep us updated.
Well, I sure appreciate you having me us here, David.
You got it. All right. And with that, we'll go back to Terry in the studio and back to our regularly scheduled programming. You're listening to 100.1 FM, KMXT.